This is Terrence McNally, and this week I share with you one of my favorite previously recorded interviews with Jon Kabat-Zinn, author of Wherever You Go, There You Are, and Trudy Goodman, founder of Insight LA, about the practice of mindfulness. This interview originally aired in September 2010. You startle awake to a rude alarm clock. Nothing you'd rather do than sleep a bit more. Coffee gets you going enough to make it out the door on time, and on your morning commute you zone out, oblivious to the radio reports of that morning's weather disasters and war casualties. At work, juggling your cell phone, landline, Palm Pilot, iPhone, email, electronic calendar. You speak to countless faithless people, all without leaving your desk. You grab lunch hunched over a pile of paperwork. You look up from the traffic on the drive home to notice what must have been a beautiful sunset. You work late. Your drive is slow. You put off exercise till tomorrow. And at the end of the day, you're back where you started. Sound familiar? Well, what gets lost in that daily shuffle? What toll is stress taking on your body? Is there some way you could lead a fuller, happier life? One of today's guests, Jon Kabat-Zinn, says the answer may be, quote, living life moment by moment as if it really mattered. He believes that by practicing what he calls mindfulness, we can literally and metaphorically come to our senses, not just as individuals, but as a society. And our other guest, Trudy Goodman, has done a lot to make that practice accessible here in L.A. with the Insight L.A. Center in Santa Monica. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Jon Kabat-Zinn, Ph.D., is a professor of medicine emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, where he was founder of the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society, and founding director of its world-renowned stress reduction clinic. In 1993, his work in the stress reduction clinic was featured in Bill Moyers' PBS special, Healing in the Mind. He's the author of Full Catastrophe Living, Using the Wisdom of Your Body and Mind to Face Stress, Pain, and Illness. He's also the author of the bestseller, Wherever You Go, There You Are, Mindfulness, Meditation, and Everyday Life. And his latest books are Coming to Our Senses, Healing Ourselves and the World Through Mindfulness, and a couple of shorter books that came out recently, and let me see. One is called Letting Everything Become Your Teacher, a compilation, a smaller compilation, easy accessible book of some of his earlier work. And his work has contributed to a growing movement of mindfulness within mainstream institutions, medicine, law, education, business, corrections and prisons, sports. Over 200 medical centers and clinics nationwide and abroad now use mindfulness-based stress reduction. Jon was a guest a couple of times before on the show. On one of those occasions, he was joined by his wife, Myla Kabat-Zinn. We talked about mindful parenting. And the book that they wrote together, Everyday Blessings, is still available, and I highly recommend it. It basically says, how can you bring mindfulness to parenting? By the way, the Zinn in both of their names is her maiden name, and her father is the late historian and activist so beloved here at Pacifica, Howard Zinn. Trudy Goodman has trained and practiced in two fields for over 25 years, meditation and psychotherapy. She studied developmental psychology with Jean Piaget, Lawrence Kohlberg, and Carol Gilligan, and trained with a widely respected psychiatrist, psychoanalyst in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Richard Chasen, MD. And for 20 years, Trudy worked with children, teenagers, couples, and individuals in a full psychotherapy practice. Since 1974, she's also devoted much of her life to practicing Buddhist meditation. She taught mindfulness with Jon Kabat-Zinn in the early days of the mindfulness-based stress reduction clinic at University of Massachusetts. And in 2002, she founded Insight LA, dedicated to teaching mindfulness to people from cradle to grave. In addition, she teaches awareness and compassion practices at USC, UCLA, Children's Hospital of LA, and a variety of community settings. Welcome, Jon Kabat-Zinn and Trudy Goodman, Ph.D., to Free Forum.
Thank you, Terrence.
Thank
Wonderful
you, Terrence.
To be here. And hi, Trudy.
Hi, Jon.
So Jon is in Massachusetts by phone. Trudy Goodman is in the studio with me. And any of you who've listened to the show know that I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we deal with. And so I'm going to ask you both the same first question. How did you initially discover mindfulness, or whatever you called it when you first discovered it? And then how did it become a focus of your professional life? And who wants to go first? John, you go first.
All right. I grew up in a family where my father was a scientist and my mother was an artist, and I was exposed to a whole range of different kinds of ways of knowing and beautiful expressions of creativity. And in my own education, I began to sort of wonder how these different worlds of science and art could come together. And at a certain point, during the Vietnam War and all of the tumult of the 60s, I began to be exposed to various Buddhist meditation practices and yoga practices, and found that they were incredibly valuable in my own life in keeping a certain kind of interior balance in the face of all the craziness that was going on in the world. And I found that they actually gave me greater sort of insight and perspective on how to, you know, be involved in social change and how to be involved as a scientist and how to love the beauty in the world in a way that gave me a kind of direction that felt very satisfying and that I had never felt before. And so, to make a long story short, I felt that there was a certain kind of understanding that comes out of the meditative traditions that I was being exposed to, and that it would be incredibly valuable to find ways to link that up to our own culture so that it didn't seem like we were trying to turn everybody into Buddhists or whatever. And I don't consider myself to be a Buddhist either, but merely an enthusiastic student of Buddhist meditation practices in their most universal guise. So, to make a long story short again, I was just like meditating on what my job would be on the planet with a capital J if I followed what my heart was really saying. And it led over many years to finally developing the stress reduction clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, and this program that is now goes under the name Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. And because I was trained as a scientist, I could do various kinds of research about the outcomes of training people in these kinds of things when they have severe and serious medical problems, and found that regular Americans who had no interest in meditation were responding tremendously to these kinds of things, far more than they were to much of the traditional medical treatments that they were receiving.
Very good. Okay, and Trudy, so how did you first get involved, and then how did it take over part of your life?
Well, it's interesting because my father was also a scientist, and he was a physician, so he was an academic physician, and he worked for the World Health Organization. And my mom was a homemaker, and her life was devoted to us, the children, and to service, volunteer work in the community. And I feel that I grew up with these ideals of service to the world and my father's interest in healing and world health. And how I encountered mindfulness is really, it's a story where my life intersects with John's, because I had done everything right. I had gone to a good school. I had married a nice Jewish boy. I had I had gotten good grades. I did everything right. And somehow, my young life, there was a lot of loss, and I was perplexed. How could this be when I had done everything right? And so I was searching, and I knew John already because our fathers had worked together at the Pasteur Institute in Paris. So our families, knew each other, and we were friends as teenagers. And our paths crossed again in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And it was actually through John and our mutual friend Larry Rosenberg that I was introduced to mindfulness practice and mindfulness meditation. And it opened the doors. It was really what I had been looking for. I had gone to study with Jean Piaget in Geneva in Switzerland because he studied the mind, and he was interested in how we come to know things and the birth of intelligence. And He also studied, I thought he was interested in child development.
Well,
and
I mean,
you would think
right? This is Terrence here. I mean, I studied Piaget myself and Kohlberg, both of them. I didn't realize until I did your bio today you studied with both of them.
I
studied
did.
With both of them also, not with Piaget, but Kohlberg and studying Piaget. And that's interesting what you say, that you thought he was studying the development of children, but in fact...
Well, what happened is I was a mom. I was so interested in the development of just watching my daughter's mind unfold. And when I got to Piaget's institute, the Institut des Sciences de l'Éducation in Geneva, what I discovered is that he said it. He said, you know, I only study children because I can't interview, he said, early man, but we would say early people. He said he felt that children recapitulated in their development what he imagined had happened with the birth and development, evolution of human beings. And that was really his sole interest in children.
They were standing in for Neanderthals.
They were standing in, yes, exactly, exactly. But I was interested in the emotional lives and hearts of children as well. So when I re-met John and was introduced to this practice of mindfulness, it offered me a way to complete the more cognitive understanding and development that I had learned with Kohlberg, with Piaget, with the developmental psychologists.
So now it's helping your own inner life and so on, but then it becomes a focus. I mean, you're a psychotherapist, you're a PhD. When does it become, I mean, you're not out here, you're out here, you moved to LA and you started an insight center.
Yes, and I think it became a focus. It became the focus of my life's work when I was married to somebody who was a mindfulness teacher, a Zen teacher, and we taught together for many, many years in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And when that part of my life ended and I came to Los Angeles to help out my family members who were here, all I wanted to do was to share and to offer what had been such a source of healing and transformation in my life and in the lives of hundreds and hundreds of children and families and everybody that I had been working with.
Okay. I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Trudy Goodman. And she is the founder of Insight LA in Santa Monica. And you can learn more about their work at insightla.org. And my other guest today is Jon Kabat-Zinn, author of many books, including the best-selling Wherever You Go, There You Are, Coming to Our Senses, Letting Everything Become Your Teacher, etc. Very good. Okay, so we've said mindfulness many times. You made the point, Jon, that you are not, you don't call yourself a Buddhist, but you practice something that Buddhists practice.
Yes.
Trudy, do you consider yourself a Buddhist?
I do and I don't. I definitely practice Buddhist meditation and teach that as a way of life. But I can't say that because I'm Jewish and those are my roots and my family connections. And I think what I would mostly say is, you know, my family, if I say I'm a Buddhist, they kind of maybe have a little bit of a... mild shudder. But when I am a Buddha, when I live from the values of this tradition, which are universal values, they're central to every great spiritual tradition, then I feel really aligned with what's true, true.
Very good. So,
and I would just point out, Terrence, that even the Buddha himself was not a Buddhist, and the word Buddhism was actually coined by Europeans in about the 17th century.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that. And it somehow both the location and the timing makes very good sense to me.
Right. So I think what Trudy's saying about it being really profoundly universal, the discoveries that the Buddha made in his own life and that he shared with people over the course of his lifetime, they're still alive and vibrant now, and the real reason for it is that they do have this profound transformative potential.
Now here's
and then
question.
Everybody gets the opportunity to investigate that for themselves because no one else can do this work for you.
Here's a question I've never asked, which is mindfulness, I'll tell you what. You can I'll let either one of you define it. But here's my question. Did it originate with the Buddha? Because to some extent, it seems to me that there must be indigenous people who never had contact with the Buddha who know enough to listen to their breath or pay attention to silence and so on.
Absolutely, on every continent for that matter, so and in every era. So what the Buddha tapped into are really universal truths that are part and parcel of our humanity and really enfolded into our DNA. But at the same time, he gave the most articulate and robust and clear stating of the potential for the mind to actually liberate itself from all sorts of suffering that that we create for ourselves, much of it around thinking and the way we react to situations that threaten us.
Okay, I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Jon Kabat-Zinn, author of many books on mindfulness, including the best-selling Wherever You Go, There You Are. His latest is Letting Everything Become Your Teacher. He will be in L.A. October 6th at Royce Hall. You can learn more about that event by going to the website Komen, K-O-M-E-N, L.A. County, all one word, KomenLAcounty.org. And my other guest today is Trudy Goodman. She's the founder of Insight LA in Santa Monica, which is a center that, as I say, she founded over the last few years, in which there are practices and programs in which you can apply mindfulness in all sorts of areas. And I will give you time before this hour is up, Trudy, to tell us more about that. But for anyone who this is fairly new to, and I'll give it to you, Trudy, now. What is mindfulness? What is that practice?
So what is mindfulness? This is a wonderful question. But in one way, mindfulness is whatever we do when we're being fully here, really present in our lives. It's not something mysterious that you have to go study philosophy to understand. It's really very, very simple. But it's not so easy to do because we're pulled in so many different directions. As you were saying at the beginning, Terrence, and as John's been saying, to be present with experience as it's happening, to have our minds and our bodies and our hearts in the same place at the same time, this is what mindfulness is about. Last night we started a class and there were probably 40, 45 people going around in a circle to say why they had come to learn mindfulness-based stress reduction, the program that John designed at the medical school in Worcester years and years ago, maybe 35 or so. And so many people spoke about wanting to feel that they were living a more authentic life, that they could be present with what was going on in their lives without running away, turning away, being unhappy, and so forth. They want to experience the fullness of their own humanity, which is, after all, our birthright as human beings, to know how to show up for our lives and fully meet each moment with our whole hearts when we choose to do that. So mindfulness is a way of being present with experience as it's happening, with a particular, with an attitude of kindness, of caring, of acceptance. It's an attentiveness that has an affectionate quality that supports it. So it's very different from the sort of self-surveillance that we might think is mindfulness, where we're kind of watching ourselves all day long, but that's usually critical. And we're usually judging ourselves and others all day long. With the kind of presence that we learn to develop and strengthen and cultivate, we already have it, but we learn to develop and strengthen and cultivate that as a way of learning how to accept ourselves and love ourselves, ultimately, just the way we are.
Right. Wherever you go, there you are, just the way you are.
Exactly.
I would say, it's just so beautifully said, Trudy, and the only thing I would add is that it has an element of befriending oneself in a very profound way that we're really not used to. we're so caught up in judgments about ourselves and so caught up in being driven to get here or get there or to find this or make that happen, and then we'll be okay. And, of course, you can really stumble into your grave all the way thinking that there's some better thing that once you get that, then you'll be okay. And so this is really a message that's saying no matter what's going on with you, you're already okay, and there's already more right with you than wrong with you as long as you're breathing. And the potential here is to actually pour energy into what's right with you through a kind of very simple way of paying attention to the actual unfolding of our lives from moment to moment to moment.
Okay.
In the only moment, by the way, we ever have, which is this one. And then learning how to reside, so to speak, in the comfort of our own being and in this remarkable quality that we have that never gets any attention, and that is awareness.
Yeah.
That can actually govern our choices and the way we live our lives in ways that thinking, which is another powerful function that we're very good at as human beings, cannot do, because thinking usually drives us into anxiety, usually drives us into depression, usually drives us into, you know, just attempting to always be better than we actually are without recognizing that in some sense you're perfect exactly as you are. And so and that includes all the warts and pimples and imperfections that the mind could come up with to say, oh, well, he doesn't know who I am because there's no way I'm perfect. And so perfect within that imperfection allows us to really settle into something that I want to just say as a scientist, we are now able to study in very sophisticated ways, and that demonstrates that it has profound effects on our state of mind and on our physiology and in our brains and on our immune system that are very much in the direction of well-being.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, say a little more about that. As you prefaced that last statement of being a scientist, my guess is that when both of you or each of you began practicing, it was because of the experience you had, but there was not nearly the research at that point. So what is some of what we've learned when we've put our, you know, Western scientific view onto this simple practice?
Well, what we're finding, if I'll go first on this one, if that's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that these little shifts in going from the, say, doing mode to being mode actually influence the brain, as I mentioned, and the immune system, and our relationship to painful sensations in the body, depressive rumination in the mind, that it turns out that how you pay attention and how you are in relationship to your thoughts and emotions, especially the destructive and discomforting thoughts and emotions, makes a profound difference in our biology. And this was not known 32 years ago when I started the stress reduction clinic. The science of the mind-body connection has really blossomed in even the last 10 years in ways that are really extraordinary. And for one, since you started out talking about stress and the stresses of daily life in the now overwhelmingly digital era that we're living in, it's now been demonstrated that unmitigated stress in our lives can actually take years off our life, and the mechanism for doing that is that it shortens the chromosome, the repeat subunits of DNA called telomeres that are at the ends of all of our chromosomes. So stress actually enhances the rate of cell death and cell senescence, and is now thought to be a major way in which we accelerate through, you know, the way we live, our own morbidity and mortality. If you were to learn ways to actually be in wiser relationship to the stress, because a lot of the stress we can't do that much about, but how we learn to be in relationship to it so that it flows more through us rather than accumulates inside of us can make a huge difference in not only the quality of our life, but for that matter, potentially, and this research is in its early stages, the quantity of our life.
So what I was going to ask, though, is that people do not die of stress. People die of cancer, heart disease, et cetera, et cetera. But what you're saying is that stress and the effect it has accelerates those or impacts
kinds of disease processes. But it also accelerates just the normal aging process. And so people do die of old age, so to speak. I mean, yes, some weak link finally goes. But if we're overall accelerating the aging process on the cellular level, then that is not a good thing if there's something that we can do to modify that.
Yeah, it's
Now it's obvious, you know, the science is so powerful that that is actually the case. And there's a whole new field called epigenetics,
right,
which means how you behave, how you actually choose to live your life, can actually influence hundreds, if not thousands, of genes that are upregulated or downregulated that really have a lot to do with how we deal with toxins in the outer world and exposure to that, inflammatory responses at a cellular level in many different organs, oncogenes and things like that. So it just saying that all of the things that we knew 100 years ago or 30 years ago, long before this science came along, that the mind actually can influence the body in ways that are profoundly important in terms of overall health and well-being, both on the mental health side and on the physical health side, and ultimately, if you will, at the level of meaning and, you know, spirituality and so forth, that these things we can be a player in that regard if we're willing to participate in our own health and well-being.
Right.
And lots of different behaviors can influence it, too. I mean, exercise certainly does. Diet certainly does. So it's not just like meditate or else. But people, when they come to understand what meditation is really about, it's not one more thing you have to do. It's a kind of rotation in consciousness that allows you to be present with whatever's unfolding in ways that are profoundly satisfying or potentially profoundly valuable when you're dealing with the proverbial stuff that is hitting the proverbial fan. And lots of us are doing that pretty much day in and day out.
Okay. I'm Terrence McNally. My guests today are Jon Kabat-Zinn, the author of many books and really a pioneer in the use of mindfulness, the utilization of mindfulness in all sorts of parts of society. His early bestseller, Wherever You Go, There You Are, probably introduced a lot of people to this. And his latest is Letting Everything Become Your Teacher. Trudy Goodman is the a PhD psychotherapist, but really, since her move to LA in 2002, the founder and of an organization called Insight LA. That's one word, Insight LA. You can learn about that at insightla.org. They're located on Olympic Boulevard in Santa Monica. And again, very much what Insight LA and Trudy do is to spread this wisdom and this practice into different corners of our life. I want to respond to what you had just finished saying, John, about genetics and so on. I recently interviewed Bruce Lipton, who has a book called Biology of Belief, and our whole conversation really focused on that the model that I think many people have, myself included up until recently, of genetics was that it's a blueprint. It's a formula kind of, and you are born, you've got these genes, and you then just live out the unfolding of that blueprint. And I think that was our understanding.
Right. That's certainly the case.
And what's happened is that as we study this, we have learned, as you said, epigenetics, which is that your genetics, your genes are not your fate. They are not your destiny.
Correct.
That it is the interaction with what's called your environment. But it turns out your environment isn't merely where you live, what you eat, how you exercise. Your environment includes your emotional and your mental and your spiritual inner environment that influences your genes. And the good way of thinking about that, as you were pointing out, John, is it's an empowering bit of knowledge that we've discovered. It actually gives you more power your life is not dictated to you. You are a participant in actually even how your genes will unfold.
Yes, and also we now refer to that as a certain plasticity of the chromosomes. In other words, it used to be thought, just as you said, that the chromosomes were like, you know, the blueprint for your life, blue eyes or brown eyes, and you know, that was it. But what was not understood was how dynamic the body is and how dynamic the interface between the chromosomes and everything else that dictates how things are unfolding from moment to moment in our biology. The word that's used for that is plastic. In other words, it's continually changing. And another discovery in science, also very relevant, is that the brain is the same way. It's an organ of complete relationality in terms of changing conditions. So the brain, which used to be thought to be, you know, something that by the age of two, you just lost neurons in the central nervous system in the brain, and it was downhill from about there.
Yeah.
Now it's understood that the brain is continually remorphing itself in different configurations depending on experience, and that it's actually making new functional neurons until the day you die in certain areas like the hippocampus that are involved in, you know, motion regulation and things like that, so that we do have much more of a role to play than we ever dreamed possible in terms of both the quality of our life and the quality of our health. Very exciting, because it's very motivating to people. And say,
exactly.
Well, I mean, it may not be the, you know, the sort of total answer, but why not hedge my bets in the direction of trying to direct the entire system in ways that are balanced and beneficial, and really in the direction of not only well-being, but a certain kind of happiness that we all long for, but very often seems totally elusive. What if it were already here and that we just were ignoring it?
Yeah, and one of the things I like about all of this is that it is so easy existentially, politically, socially, to feel victim. We live in a crazy world. Many of us come from crazy families. We see crazy things happening politically, economically, environmentally, and I think it is easy, I think, to feel a victim, a small little cog overwhelmed by all of this. And anything that gives us a shift from victim to active participant to creator is a powerful thing to tap into. Now,
beautifully said.
Thank you. I want to ask, and I'll let Trudy start this one off. When I've asked you about mindfulness, when we've talked about it, there seems to be two things. One is the state. Both of you have said it at different moments. It is available to be mindful, to be present, to be alive in the moment, to be aware is available with no special practices. So there's the state of it. Then there are the practices which seem to foster it. So, Trudy, if you would speak to those two different aspects of it.
The state of mindfulness is an experience that we have that, as we've been saying, is always available to us any time we are a little bit mindful about ourselves, attentive and present to what's going on, noticing what's going on.
And let me just see, the moment when you look up from your desk when you're working and you notice that there's a sunset going on.
Exactly.
Or your child walks into the room. This is a quote, actually, and I'm getting moved again, John. This is so funny, from the interview I did with you and Myla many years ago. Your child walks into the room and you really see them in that moment, that you can be truly present. Just it comes in like that, right?
Yes, and just as you're so moved by that idea of being fully seen as a child, all of us are longing for this, to be seen, to be known, the good for our goodness to be known. And this is a kind of attention that we can offer to ourselves. And actually, the more that we are able to offer this to ourselves, the more likely it is that this will be the kind of attention we receive from others and can offer to others. And I'm really now devoting my life to teaching people the tools and the skills that will make this experience more likely to happen. And those are what we call the mindfulness practices. So,
for instance,
we teach John's work, the mindfulness-based stress reduction. And I've extrapolated from that work to teach mindfulness, how to be with death and dying for people who are caring for sick children and dying children at Children's Hospital, but also for all of us, how do we deal with the loss or death of loved ones or of jobs or whatever else may be vanishing from our life? How can we begin to see this as an opening, an opportunity?
Well, for someone who this is new to, or they've kind of heard of it, but this is the first time they've really said, you know, I'm thinking about this. What does a practice of mindfulness, what is it like? And does it have to be meditation, or is it something else than that?
Well, think of meditation, first of all, as just a little slice of your life where you decide you're not going to be distracted by the phone or the anything, the email. You're going to set aside a little bit, just a little slice of your life to be, to just be, to be present with whatever experience is happening. We're not teaching trying to reach some sort of altered state of bliss or calm or not thinking. We are actually teaching the simplest practices of being with one's breath, with the sensations in the body, with the sounds of life around us. This is what I'm calling meditation. But we teach how to be present as you walk, as you eat, as you interact with people, as you work. These skills and tools are not just for, you know, the half hour that we might be able to, I don't know how clear from our busy life, to sit and be quiet and do nothing while our to-do list whirls around in our mind. We're really...
So is it that if... that the reason or the way we might use a time of sitting and paying attention to our breath, or a time of sitting and paying attention to metta, you know, which is the form that I do, is actually going to make it more likely that we can experience presence when we're not sitting. In other words, it's like an athlete. If you practice it, if you practice your serve, just your serve for quite a while, you're more likely to serve well when you're playing.
If you practice taking charge of your attention for the briefest period of time each day, it will definitely generalize into the rest of your life, which is what you're talking about. You know, sometimes we were talking about you and John were talking about the environment, creating the environment that will make it more likely for our whole body, our cells, our genes, our chromosomes, everything to thrive. I sometimes think that we are being mental and physical environmentalists when we practice mindfulness. We're cleaning up our own environment. And of course, then too, we're not so preoccupied and distracted. We can look around at the world and see what needs to be done and help out in ways that may not have been possible for us before. So this isn't just, it's a source of personal healing and how to work with and transform experiences of pain, loss, and so forth, but also a way to begin to see ourselves, each other, and our world, and serve our world with more generosity and creativity.
Okay, John, you want to add anything to what I'm talking about? Is the practice and the presence.
I love what Trudy's saying. And I'm just trying to resonate with all of the people who are listening in this moment, and really want to communicate that that whether it's the word meditation or the word mindfulness or anything like that, that whatever it is that you're thinking it is, it isn't, because it's not one more concept or one more idea or, as I said, one more thing that you have to do. And it's very hard for us to really take this in, and it's hard for me to even articulate what it is, because it's not a technique. It's not a way of it's a way of being as opposed to a technique. You're not trying to get anywhere else. But what you're really trying to do, as Trudy was suggesting, is be where you already are. It turns out we're almost never where we already are, because we're either sort of planning or worrying about what hasn't happened yet, or we're in the past obsessing over what has happened that we didn't like, or the good old days that are so much better than now. And so the present moment, which is the only time we're ever alive in, ever could take a breath in or express love in or delight in, is kind of obliterated, squeezed totally. So so that if we wind up living our lives that way, we might miss a great deal of the landscape of our own experience for days, weeks, months, and years and decades. And so what mindfulness is really about is a way of seeing and a way of being that gives us back our moments, and in such a way that we don't need to get out ahead of ourselves striving to get somewhere else or make something happen. And it's kind of paradoxical. In that way, all life really becomes the meditation practice. So it's not necessarily about sitting or lying down or doing mindful yoga at a particular time of day, although those formal practices are incredibly valuable and really create a foundation for deepening this kind of thing. But once one is anchored in that kind of formal practice, it does spill out into the entirety of your day, so that every moment can be a moment of presence and, as Trudy said, a kind of affectionate attention and generosity towards oneself and others and the world in ways that really bring, if you'll pardon my putting it this way, a degree of wisdom into the equation and a degree of compassion into the equation that the world itself is starving for. And authenticity is a part of this. This is not some kind of play acting. This is living your life as if it really mattered in the only moment you get a chance to do it. And our discovery over the past 30 years plus is that Americans, regular people like ourselves, take to this like ducks to water. I've known Trudy since she was 14 years old, as you've heard, and then I was 15. And I got to say that, you know, it's unbelievably improbable that she and I would have gotten into this in the first place, or that, you know, so many years later we would still be into it as, like, not just our work, but our love and our passion. That's kind of what we're finding is true for literally millions of people who are getting back in touch with who they actually are through this simple practice. And there's no one right way to do it. It's not like you follow somebody's formula. This is not a formula. It's one's own love affair, if you will, with the present moment and a capacity to really befriend even the more difficult challenges that we face in ways that, as I've said, are healing in so many ways.
I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Jon Kabat-Zinn, author of many books and one of the people who has spread mindfulness both widely and deeply into medicine, prisons, education, and so on. And my other guest today is Trudy Goodman, who has spread mindfulness in the Los Angeles area as the founder of Insight LA. You can learn more about John's work at jonkabat-zinn.com. Does that work with or without the hyphen?
It's no, only with the hyphen.
Okay, so it's J-O-N-K-A-B-A-T hyphen Z-I-N-N, jonkabat-zinn.com. And more about Trudy's work at insightla.org. Trudy, you wanted to add something to what John said, and then I'd like you take this moment, we've only got 7 minutes or so left, to tell what's available in Los Angeles through Inside LA.
Yes, John was speaking to all of you listeners about what meditation and mindfulness are and aren't, and I loved when you said, you know, just a way to really connect with who we truly are, and we do all long for this. And I was just laughing because so often when we think of meditation, we think of, you know, the children tease me about levitation or out-of-the-body experiences. But you know what? We're having out-of-the-body experiences all day long. How often are you
in
your body?
So
we're trying to, you know, create opportunities to have in-the-body experiences. And our bodies, there is such a dread and fear and loathing about our bodies in our culture. And so how do we, this is also a way to connect with, to have an in-the-body experience, which can be an experience of befriending our bodies as well, and how we nurture and care for our bodies. And so I just wanted to add that. And in terms of Insight LA, you know, I started Insight LA because when I moved to Los Angeles, I felt disconnected. It seemed like there was a kind of centripetal force that scattered people, and that everybody was longing for community. And it wasn't just me, because I was new in town. So I thought, I want to create a space where people can come as they are, a come-as-you-are center, where people can be who they are and explore who they are. And so through a variety of classes, of days that we set aside, retreat from our busy lives to be together and do these things together and explore what it is, we have beginners classes, basics classes. We have classes in Buddhist psychology and philosophy. We have Buddhist meditation retreats, and we have the completely secular teachings, the non-sectarian teachings of that are mindfulness-based. We have classes in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for treatment of relapse and depression. We're going to be offering classes for treatment of relapse in addictions. And we have, as I said earlier, the mindfulness-based stress reduction classes that are ongoing, some of them specifically for people with chronic pain or disease, and some of them, you know, just for everybody. We have just a lot of, and we have a wonderful community of caring and engaged people. I feel so privileged and blessed when I think of the friends that I've made and the people who've met each other, including people who've found each other, gotten married, have babies. You know, we've really, it's a wonderful community, and people are welcome to come and go as it suits their lives.
Okay, so that you can learn more about at InsightLA, one word, insightla.com. And I will just share that when you first moved out here, you were doing meditation in a friend's living room, and that's where you and I met in that living room. And so it's been pretty exciting for me to watch what you've been able to generate here. Let me say, if I say we've got about four more minutes, let me throw it. There may be people who say this sounds like it's all well and good, but how are we going to fix the world if we're so busy paying attention to how we feel? So who wants to take that one on? And let me just give, I think I've got a quote here there's a famous quote from Gandhi. Gandhi said, "Those who say spirituality has nothing to do with politics do not know what spirituality really means." John?
Yeah, well, I agree. This is incredibly important. And one of the reasons that I started the Stress Reduction Clinic was not merely to help individuals, but in some sense, I meant it to be a public health intervention from the very beginning, that it would move the bell-shaped curve of medicine itself and healthcare itself, and out beyond that of society, because the way we govern ourselves, our economy, everything else is really driven by our minds. And when the minds, our minds are primarily driven by, say, greed, you know, the motivation of more for me and everything else be damned, or hatred and anger, like those people aren't really human and we gotta get them before they get us, or just deep cultural misunderstandings, which we can very easily fall into, and you see in the newspaper every single day, and the kind of delusion that involves just mistaking our ideas and opinions for reality. Well, if you look at the Congress, it looks a lot like greed, hatred, and delusion. If you look at a lot of the way that politics is unfolding, driven by self-interest, where self is defined in a very, very small way. And some of the implications of mindfulness really don't simply have to do with the health of one particular person's body, but of the body politic, that if we could actually learn how to modulate those kinds of forces in ourselves that really have to do with contraction, and understood those capacities that we have that have to do with clarity and wisdom and compassion, that we could actually transform our laws and the way we conduct business and the way we work internationally with other countries so that we minimize the impulses to destroy each other and ourselves, if we think about the environment and what we're doing to it, and we optimize the potential for human beings to live in some way in harmony with other life forms and beings, whether in the, you know, we're talking about the rainforest or we're talking about endangered animal species, in a way that just adds value to the potential for our planet to actually make it, as opposed to human beings winding up being, in some sense, the autoimmune disease of the planet that we are the, you know, the disease agent and also the first victims of it. And it all has to do with whether the human mind knows itself or not. So the challenge of this era is, in some sense, for us to wake up to the full dimensionality of our being while we actually have the chance. And there are people in Congress, Tim Ryan from the Youngstown Congressional District in Ohio, who are actually promoting mindfulness in the Congress and trying to, you know, get money for it to fund mindfulness in public education, in the schools, and in healthcare, and also in the armed forces. That would take a whole other program to say what's going on in the armed forces with mindfulness now.
I've got to bring it to a close. Thank you. So again, the websites are jonkabat-zinn.com, J-O-N-K-A-B-A-T. -Zinn, JonKabat-Zinn.com, and InsightLA.org. That's one word, InsightLA. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly either at iTunes or at TerrenceMcNally.net or at AWorldThatJustMightWork.com. You can get my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about by emailing me at TEMcNally@Mac.com. TEMcNally@Mac.com. You can also do that at the website. Thank you to Devin Jordan, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic. Thank you, Jon Kabat-Zinn and Trudy Goodman. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence.
Thank you.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. Check out this clip from my show. Over the last couple of weeks, we did a couple of stories relating to the genetic modification of human embryos. There was the announcement from 2 weeks ago about the first time that there had been genetic modification done of human embryos in China. We won't rehash the entire story, but you can check it out. Needless to say, it's still a technology that's a long time from widespread application. We also heard yesterday or the day before on the bonus show that the National Institute of Health in the U.S. will not allow this type of experimentation and will not provide any funding for it, rather. So right now, let's talk about the morals and the ethics of this. That's what I want to discuss today. Right now, it would be immoral to start modifying viable embryos that could result in live births, because the technology is just not there, right? There is no reliability that you would be able to make a modification that would not horribly damage the embryo in a way that would lead to a horrible life if there would even be a birth. But once the technology improves, the chances of huge errors that lead to, you know, catastrophic medical repercussions will decrease significantly. And then I'm actually wondering if it would be unethical not to genetically modify embryos when they could maybe remove genetic defects that make people predisposed to certain diseases or early death or a lower quality of life. How could we argue that it will be unethical to modify human embryos when around 40% of people get cancer at some point, and maybe modifying embryos could reduce that? And people will argue, what, that it's immoral because of religious reasons, or you're playing God, or what? If we think about it that way, might it not be immoral not to do these modifications once the process is perfected?
Once again, I will bring up the movie Gattaca, which was way ahead of its time. It kind of addresses this, and it's brilliant. But I think as this becomes more normal, perhaps it will be, you know, if you know that your child has this certain percentage of this horrible disease or illness, then, yeah, I mean, wouldn't you be a terrible person if you couldn't quickly and cheaply make sure that your child does not have this horrible, debilitating disease.
Yeah, now the cheaply thing we'll talk about because you brought that up before, and we'll get to that. But if you imagine, for example, that there was a certain point at which, I don't know, antibiotics were really expensive, let's say, for example, and they were still being tested, and it wasn't really clear what the side effects would be. But eventually, once we figured out that antibiotics are mostly safe, and they can save people, they can prevent people from dying from conditions that did kill people 100 years ago. Doesn't it become immoral? Wouldn't it be immoral today not to give a child antibiotics because you don't believe in that type of thing? You think it's immoral. There are some religions that think that, and we think that by and large, the secular world thinks that they're a little bit crazy. If genetic modification of human embryos does become effective at fixing the predispositions towards certain diseases, and it's affordable, as Lewis said, it may be seen as equally odd not to do that. But let's talk pragmatically about what Lewis brought up, right? Only the rich will have access to this, Lewis said when we discussed this a couple of weeks ago. It won't level the playing field much if the only people who can afford genetic modification of human embryos are those who have the blind luck of being born into the 1% or the 0.1%. There is a good chance that this type of genetic modification could increase the gap between those who can and cannot afford it. But if you look at a government subsidy for those who cannot afford it, and you couple that with efficiency of scale, I can see this being affordable for people who want it because it's fiscally conservative, or it could be. You could make a case, Lewis, that there's a high value to avoiding certain diseases. Once it's available, the rich are going to pay for this anyway, right? And if we can subsidize the potential successful genetic human embryo modification for people who can't afford it, there's probably a long-term health benefit, a financial benefit of improved health for all that would reflect itself in reduced emergency room visits and long-term care for certain conditions. So while I agree that there's probably going to be a period where this type of thing, whatever it ends up being, will only be available to the rich, there's a pretty good case to be made as to why it should be subsidized by the government if and when it becomes reliable, safe, and predictable.
Agreed. I mean, for the foreseeable future, it will be available primarily only for the rich. But we are in a phase where this is being, you know, this is still experimental.
Of course.
We are still figuring out how to do this. And so there will be people who are lucky enough to be able to participate in trials and experiments to see if this works, and hopefully with some success.
Another question is, how will all societies care for the elderly after annual improvements in techniques and methodologies for genetic modification? Will we see a change as a society in terms of the attitude towards the elderly? And it's not really even a fair question to ask it that way, because different societies already see the elderly in drastically different ways. So we would have to see how it would affect different societies. But I think that that's also a question that would need to be discussed as any type of life extension technology and disease prevention technology becomes more prevalent.
Yeah, it is an interesting time. Things are changing, David, and are you ready? We are about to go into the future.
Who knows? And if you're hearing this and you are truly and honestly convinced that none of this stuff will ever happen, please email me and explain to me why you have that point of view. I would be very interested.
It has already happened. I think it's just going to be a snowball effect now. You can't stop this. It's going to happen.
Tweet us, twitter.com/DavidPackmanShow.
You've been listening to part of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and more, go to davidpakman.com and check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/The David Pakman Show.
Here's what's happening on The Leslie Marshall Show on the Progressive Voices Network. The Indian Removal Act of 1830 forced Native Americans off their ancestral homes throughout the southeastern portion of the United States. And as a result, thousands of Native Americans died on their journey to what was designated, quote, Indian Territory west of the Mississippi River, where these people were completely uprooted by an act signed into law by this president, currently on our $20 bill. Now, this is a very dark chapter in our history of America, as is slavery. This is known as the Trail of Tears. Now, back in February, Women on 20s presented many female candidates that its members thought could replace Jackson on American currency. And I have to say, I think a good guy to remove. I think we could all agree that we need to correct history. We need to right the wrongs whenever and wherever it is possible. The Leslie Marshall Show, Monday to Friday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on the Progressive Voices Network.